This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello there, Leo and Eric.
Hi, Matt.
Hey.
Hi, Matt.
Great. Okay, so I've already given you a bit of introduction to the show and or to the listeners out there. And I started off with just a brief thing that you're both authors, I guess activists and small farmers, and you've also been involved in organizing these Deep Green Resistance conferences. And I'm wondering if we can start from there and talk about where you guys are coming from with this and what you're hoping to accomplish.
Sure. Did you want to start the air, or should I?
You go ahead.
Okay. So DGR is a weekend conference. It's a three-day conference that we've run a couple of times, and we have some more upcoming as well. And it basically, I think, stems from our desire to engage in some more serious discussion about strategy, and it kind of emerges from what we see as a lack of large-scale strategic thinking, I guess, in activism in general, and in particular in strategic thinking that addresses the fact that the world is being destroyed, and that any particular stream of activism, whether it's, you know, civil rights, social justice, indigenous solidarity, ultimately depends on our success in stopping the world from being destroyed, whether that's in terms of global warming or any other number of ecological crises that we're facing. So Deep Green Resistance is open to people from all different backgrounds, and I think that's been one of its strengths, is that we have people who are working in many different kinds of activism, and they get to engage in a dialogue around questions and scenarios that either rarely happens or doesn't happen at all. Bia, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think one of the main motivations for me was that all of the solutions that are being proposed by the mainstream environmental movement to the ongoing ecological crisis do not match the scale of the problem. Even if every single one of us did every single one of the things that Al Gore suggests in his movie, we would only stop carbon emissions by maybe 25-27%. That does not begin to make a dent in what we need to be doing to stop this planet from becoming hotter than Venus. Okay, so we need to be talking on a much more serious level about what we're going to do, and nobody is proposing those kinds of solutions. All we're being handed is these kind of ridiculous lifestyle choices, consumer choices, and these are not political choices about how we are going to organize the material conditions of our society, and that's what's at question here if we're going to save the planet. So for me, it was a personal rage and frustration at what is being proposed by the people who are in a position of leadership, and I feel like they're really falling down on the job. I think a lot of them must feel the same kind of despair that we all feel, but they're not willing to question the bigger picture. And without doing that, we are not going to save the planet. So I think that was sort of the background that helped us come up with this Deep Green Resistance model for these workshops.
Mm. Can you talk a bit more maybe about like more of the systemic analysis you're trying to bring forth? And I imagine a lot of people listening out here, you know, may not have come across certain analysis of the system and what is going on and these false solutions we're often being given. A lot of people get pretty excited about that kind of stuff.
You want to go, Eric? Or?
Sure. Well, there are a couple of different kind of classes of solutions that tend to be proposed to, I guess we can keep using global warming as an example, some of which are based around kind of reducing consumption and some of which are based around shifting to alternatives. So if we want to talk about global warming, obviously the main source of global warming is greenhouse gas emissions created by burning fossil fuels. So we can go ahead and talk about, you know, using more efficient cars like hybrids or something like that, or, you know, compact fluorescent light bulbs. And when we do that, we immediately encounter several different problems, one of which is called Jevons' paradox, which is a paradox in economics where when you increase efficiency of say, a washing machine, people tend to use it more because it's cheaper or, you know, it costs less to use. And that increase in use can cancel out all of the progress that has been made by increasing efficiency and even make the situation worse. Another problem is that right now we have probably passed peak oil, which means that the amount of fossil fuels available to consume every year are finite and will continue to decrease into the future. So if you and I try our hardest to reduce our own fossil fuel consumption by, you know, turning the lights off when we leave the room and cutting short our hot showers, then that's not necessarily going to reduce the amount of fossil fuels that are burned on a planetary scale, because the amount is finite. And if we use less, that's just lessening the demand and making that oil cheaper for other people to buy and use. So that's, I think those are two of the important problems in terms of looking at things on a global scale. The problem is not that you and I are using, you know, hot water that comes from fossil fuels. The problem is that this is happening on a global scale, and our solutions have to take that into account. And another problem in terms of moving to alternatives, alternatives to fossil fuels in particular, one problem is that these alternatives usually involve a huge amount of investment in new infrastructure if they're going to be anything significant. So if you're talking about, you know, using solar power to run cars, then you're also talking about doubling or tripling or quadrupling the amount of electrical infrastructure in order to move that energy around. Or if you're talking, I think this is a really important one, about, say, using biofuels to replace fossil fuels like ethanol or biodiesel, you're talking about drastically increasing the amount of land that's under cultivation. I think George Monbiot did some calculations for Britain to determine what would happen if they moved completely to biofuels for their cars, and found that the amount of land that they would require would be the same as the amount of land area of all of Britain. So that doesn't even take into account, you know, other requirements for energy or other requirements for land, such as healthy, you know, natural ecosystems. And so we have this problem where, say, with ethanol, you can try to switch over to a different source of energy, but what you're really doing, especially in the case of ethanol right now, is basically subsidizing that with fossil fuels, because ethanol requires more energy to produce under most standard production means than it actually grants you in terms of ethanol energy. And it also requires huge amounts of water and soil. So you're just kind of trading what's at the top of people's minds right now, which is which is greenhouse gas emissions, for all of these other problems like water drawdown, soil erosion, habitat destruction, which will simply end up being much bigger problems in the future.
Yeah, a couple of things I want to add. Just for instance, it takes 3 times more energy to build a car than that car will use being driven with fossil fuel. So it's cars themselves that are the problem, and this is where it gets systemic. And then you have to ask about, well, what does it do to communities to have cars in them? How much land does it take to have cars, because they demand a tremendous amount of space? There literally is not enough land in China for everybody there to drive cars like we do in America or Canada. There literally is not enough land. That's how much land cars use, and they also make human community impossible, because the demands of cars are in complete opposition to what human beings need to be able to live in functional communities. So that's the systemic nature of this problem. Like, we can't just switch to another kind of fuel. Even if it existed, we would only be making the problem worse, because to produce these massive industrial products like cars or, you know, computers, just takes such a massive amount of energy to do it, that there is no way to generate that amount of energy just using sunshine. And that's ultimately what we have to come down to. How much sun falls on the planet? How can we use that in ways that do not degrade our land base, our living environment around us? And that does not leave room for industrialization. I mean, we can't have both. And that's sort of, you know, the final conclusion that people are forced to draw if they really look at the equations here. And most people don't want to do that. And I find that the problem with the leadership of the environmental movement right now is that they are not asking anyone to do that. The government certainly isn't. But I expect more from activists who care about the planet, and they're not rising to the occasion. And I find that to be a source of tremendous personal grief, because if they're not going to do it, who is?
Mm-hmm. Something else that's also left out of a lot of, almost all of the kind of environmental movement or the things people associate with being from the environmental movement is more of like a social analysis of economic and climate collapse and all that, and looking at power and looking at who holds it and looking at militarism and the prison system and all that kind of stuff. And I know one thing you guys try to address is, I don't know if this is a correct phrase you'd call it, but like future fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can kind of bring that in, because that's often environmental issues, simply caring about air and the earth is very whitewashed. And I guess that's because a lot of people don't have to really think about these things on a first-hand basis and aren't dealing with fascist responses to their communities now, like with immigrant detention centers in the States, for example. I'm kind of wondering if you can bring in some of that analysis to these things like peak oil and climate collapse.
Well, what's happening right now in America is, you know, we have this presidential campaign coming up. We've got a far-right candidate, and we have an extremely moderate candidate. There is, of course, nobody ever on the left. And John McCain has picked Sarah Palin from Alaska to be his running mate. And being from Alaska, of course, all anybody cares about is the oil. And every time she appears in public, the audience starts chanting, "Drill, baby, drill," meaning, you know, the wildlife reserves in Alaska are about to be drilled. And this, of course, has been a huge flashpoint in the environmental movement in America, is trying to keep those preserves as pristine as possible. So anyway, my point here is that as gas gets more expensive and people's living standards starts to go down, which everybody here is feeling the pinch, they don't understand why, because nobody's presented to them the fact that we have hit peak oil, that it is never going to get cheaper again. This is a way of life from the very beginning that had an end in sight. It's just nobody wanted to look at it. All of that is coming true. And what we're seeing, of course, is that people are going to cling tighter and tighter to anyone who can offer them what they think they're entitled to, which is, you know, the American way of life. We're all God-given right to drive an SUV, to use as much fossil fuel as we want. And the fact that those things are getting more and more expensive and are suddenly climbing out of reach for a lot of people makes them cling harder and harder to their belief that they have a right to this. So I just see that this just provides a huge, very fertile ground for the kind of law and order fascism that John McCain and, you know, his ilk are going to provide, or going to try to, run on those kinds of images and ideas, and I think that that's going to be very appealing to more and more people, and that is a frightening prospect. So that's kind of what's going on in America right now. I don't know if you have similar things in Canada as oil gets more expensive, whether people are already shifting right to kind of shore up their way of life, but that's going to definitely be happening in America. It's already starting.
I would also draw parallels to the 1930s. Which is that, you know, in the 1930s in Europe and in America, fascist tendencies and fascist groups were kind of festering. But it wasn't until the stock market collapse and the global economic collapse that started in 1929 that they started to really kind of get power and get influence. And what was interesting to me when I was reading a lot of the original, you know, kind of World War II documents, source documents, is that how much issues of carrying capacity basically come up. And, of course, the planet's way overshot on carrying capacity right now because of cheap oil, basically. And the Nazis had a really perverse understanding of carrying capacity that was basically what they called Lebensraum, which was driving their expansion. And this idea that they needed to expand and displace other people to get more Lebensraum, which is living space, more carrying capacity, in order to carry out, you know, what their great new world. And so when they did that, they also, Hitler in particular, was explicitly citing what, you know, Europeans had done in North America in terms of wiping out indigenous peoples in order to make more living space for themselves. So I'm really concerned about what Liera is saying and about the parallels to previous historical examples of more overt fascism.
Yeah, I think the economic decline is really, or even the economic crash, is really key here, that when people feel scared for their material survival, they're going to cling to whatever can offer them safety and security. And that is how, you know, the right wing always pitches itself, and people are going to fall for it. They already are. And the end game is already in sight. I mean, peak oil has come and gone. We are on the downslope now. It's never going to get better. And I say that out loud to people, and they look at me like I'm insane. I'm like, gas is never going to be cheap again. It's only going to get worse. You know, they've gutted everything they can gut. There is nothing left to take. You know, it's going to get more and more expensive. The cheap stuff is gone. And they don't want to hear it. It's like, this is the way God meant us to live. We were given all of this. This is just what normal life is. And when you pull all that out and say, look at the numbers here, look at the graph, think about it rationally. You know, there's only so much of a finite substance on the planet. We have used over half. It's just that blank wall. You know, you hit the brick with them, and they just want things to be the way that they were promised they were going to be, that they were going to have a middle-class life, that everything was going to be secure, they were going to buy a house and a car, drive to the mall. That's all they want to think about. And it's going to require, I don't even know what, it's going to require a lot more thought, and it's going to require a lot more courage, and it's going to require throwing all of that into question, which most people are not willing to do. They have not been prepared for that by a very conformist culture. So what they're going to do instead is cling to what they've been promised, and the people who stand up and say, we're going to make sure you get those things because you deserve them, that's who they're going to go for. And in this case, it's, you know, the John McCain crowd, the right-wingers. And, you know, the left is not offering an alternative at this point, which would be a tough alternative to sell. I mean, I can't see how anybody could win an election saying, yep, gas is never going to be cheap again. Sorry, we're looking $10 a gallon in a few years. And, you know, one thing I read said that the moment that oil hits $300 a barrel, it's going to be the smoldering ruins of the global economy, because past that, it's just not worth it for anybody to produce anything using oil. And that is where we're headed eventually. And this is what this culture as a whole needs to face, but it's not, which is sort of, I think, one of the reasons that we started to do the Deep Green Resistance workshops is if nobody's going to face that and nobody's going to do anything to stop it and the planet is going to keep dying, where does that leave us as activists? I mean, what are the points at which we can actually try to make a dent in what is happening to our planet, given that none of the public institutions who should be doing this aren't? So if we're never going to have public support on our side, if the public is never really going to be forced to face this, what does that leave us in terms of strategy and then organizing?
Mm-hmm. yeah, I'd like to maybe go somewhere with that. Like part of Eric, what you were saying earlier, something that's inspired you about the recent conference is that some discussions around linking like strategy and linking different social movements. And Lira, I was just thinking when you were saying about people's God-given right to drive SUVs, I think there's a little bit less of that I'm around anyways in Canada. But then I also think, you know, maybe not in the same language, but people are still thinking like, what about my God-given right to drive a smart car or a hybrid or have a maintenance of highways for the next, you know, centuries and all that kind of stuff, and transport trucks filling grocery stores and all that. So I think even beyond like the more kind of obscene materialism, there's still a lot of people who are, you know, who are trying to be good people and trying to be good environmentalists and all that, who aren't really questioning this kind of thing. So I'm wondering if you can maybe talk about some of that strategy you're talking about as far as linking different social movements and maybe hopefully avoiding more people getting sucked into this kind of same old stuff.
Sure. Well, I think one important step is to really look these problems in the face, especially around, you know, things like smart cars. I'm not saying people shouldn't drive a smart car, but when we do things like that, like replacing our, you know, light bulbs with compact fluorescence, we should realize that even though it's good to consume less, none of these actions are going to solve the problem. So we really have to look beyond that. And I think one of the things we were seeing at DGR was that there were kind of two streams of activism that were becoming apparent that are complementary. So one of these was around building alternatives and building healthy communities, and the other one was about taking down the systems that are exploiting people and destroying the planet. And I think they both had different kinds of organization and different kinds of immediate operational goals. And in terms of the building alternatives thread, I think one of the really important things that we heard people talking about and during the discussions and during kind of their own planning for actions that they would want to undertake later was a kind of focusing on the essentials like growing food, shelter, community, and things like that, whereas that's something that we often don't see from the larger environmental movement. You know, there's certainly a movement towards localization of food and towards moving towards toward organic, which is great, but there is a lot of this emphasis on things like hybrid cars or taking, you know, industrial systems and making them slightly more efficient. So that's one of the things that I saw that was good about the first stream. Leah, did you want to add anything? Or?
Yeah, one of the analyses that we tried to present at the beginning as sort of a framework was how a lot of times on the left, because it's so individualist in the West, and we have this tremendous kind of current of individualism that is sort of underlies liberal thought, and that has meant that for progressive movements, there's this tremendous pull toward individual solutions. Instead of looking at it as oppression as a group phenomenon, we see it as an individual phenomenon. And so there's this tendency to put forward individual solutions. So we're stuck with these, you know, kind of buy this, you know, lifestyle choice stuff. And that sort of combined with this general strategy that arose in the 60s of withdrawing from the dominant culture. Now, there's something to be said about withdrawing your emotional identification with oppressive systems, and I think we all need to do that. But as an individual, it doesn't really make a difference whether you withdraw from whatever it is that, you know, you identify as the problem. I mean, we really need to be fighting back, not withdrawing. So there was this creation of this whole kind of alternative culture on the left, and that in itself has come to be seen as a political action. And I disagree. I disagree very strongly. I think that it would be possible to have a culture that was actually a culture of resistance, but I always put that in opposition to this alternative culture, because the alternative culture is basically a dead end. It's just a way to live a happy life with nice people who share some of your values. A culture of opposition would actually be, you know, the people who are actually doing the kind of frontline activism always need two things. They need material support and they need loyalty. And if you could link a culture of resistance to the actual people who are doing the resistance, so lending that loyalty and lending that material support, if you could make those linkages happen, and it was self-consciously in political opposition to structures of power, then you would have a functioning culture of resistance. We don't have that right now on the left. I think that's a great project for people who can't do the more serious kinds of political actions. There's a million legitimate reasons why a lot of us can't be on the front lines, you know, whether it's family responsibilities, whether it's health concerns, whether it's just it's not in our personalities, whether we have moral reservations about it. I mean, there's a million reasons, and people should not undertake serious action if they can't, you know, embrace what they're doing. And no is always, you know, the fallback. But there's lots and lots of ways that we can participate in making those kinds of more radical actions happen, and we can be that culture of resistance. But we need to understand how that's different than this just sort of vague alternative culture that is sort of the fallback position right now on the left. And so we have to embrace militant action, and we have to embrace the fact that some people are going to be taking courageous actions and they're going to need our support. And whether that's material support or whether it's just being vocal in public that, you know, you support people who do this, you know, the whole range of activities that people can do to be part of a culture of actual resistance. So I'm sort of, you know, pumping this idea of the resistance culture, and what was really great about DGR was that You know, at one point we had people break up into six different kind of strategies, general strategies, starting with sort of consciousness transformation, moving on to doing above-ground organizing, like, you know, legislative strategies and running for office and that kind of stuff. And then we had the people who were doing localization, so growing food and building strong local communities. And then it sort of got more and more, you know, sort of militant, more radical, till we ended with people doing these sort of direct, you know, confrontations and kinds of more militant actions. So there was a range of possibilities people could pick in terms of... So we present the whole thing as, you know, you live in this land called Feralia, and it's been taken over by this terrible corporation named Omniv, and they're destroying the land base, they're using all the water and the soil, and they've destroyed the forest and, you know, the whole planet. Your land is dying because of this, you know, nasty corporation that controls everything. They control the culture, they control the food supply, the whole thing runs on this sort of fossil fuel-like substance, the dilithium crystals, and it has to be mined, and then they have to be transported, and then they have to be manufactured into usable form. So you can see a lot of parallels here. Anyway, so given that, that's what the situation everybody's presented with. How are you going to stop Omniv from destroying Feralia? So anyway, they were given these sort of six options in terms of political strategy, what they wanted to do. And my point here, I'm going to bring this all back, the thing that gave me the most hope was that the people who were doing group number three, which was the people who were talking about localization and growing food and trying to build strong local communities, at one point during this whole exercise that we did, some of them came up to me and they said, can we talk to the people who are doing the more militant actions? Are we allowed to make connections with them? And I was like, you got it. That was the whole point. So they did. They actually combined their groups and they figured out how they were going to do this together. So when they were able to present their final strategy, we sort of had a board of people who sort of judged what they came up with in terms of various biological indicators, you know, was it successful, they had an entire plan between those two groups that involved taking care of people locally and creating a life-affirming culture while doing direct confrontations with this terrible corporation that was killing the planet. And that was the moment that it got successful in terms of this whole role-playing activity. That was the moment when the biological indicators got better for the whole planet. Before that, nobody's actions were enough to influence the public and to actually make a dent in the destruction. But when they put those two things together, when the alternative culture actually decided to join forces with the resistance, everybody saw how successful it was. And I think that was a really key moment for everybody who was there for the weekend. So.
And another thing is that, you know, in percentage terms, you don't even need that many people on the front lines to be effective.
Right.
The majority of people in any movement are always going to be kind of in the supporting role. I think in the IRA there was something only like 3% of people in the IRA ever took up arms at any given time. But the problem is that you need those people to not just have this kind of generalized, you know, discomfort with the way that business as usual works. They actually have to be part of this strategy and they actually have to support organizations that are confronting power.
You know, like if we were in Nazi Germany and or let's say we were in France, and under occupied France, and we wanted to get rid of the Nazi occupation, we would not like have a book group and read literature and, you know, feel disaffected. I mean, we would actually have a strategy for getting rid of these people, and it would involve risk, and it would certainly involve, you know, tremendous personal discomfort. But we would think politically. We wouldn't just think in terms of our culture and our personal psychology and our, you know, consumer choices. We would have a much broader strategy that was about who was in power and how we were going to dislodge them. And that's how I want the environmental movement to start thinking, because nobody is.
Can you maybe tie this into the book you two are working on with Derek Jensen, so far kind of euphemistically called Endgame Volume 3? Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about that and introduce people to that?
Sure. Lierre and Derek and I are right now working on a book. We've been calling it the strategy book among ourselves, but it is sort of an extension of along the same trajectory as other work that Derek and Lierre and I have done in the past. And we're exploring many of these same questions and basically trying to come up with a plan, or to some extent multiple plans and strategies that really would be effective at taking down civilization, is the term that we often use. which basically means to get rid of these multiple interlocking exploitative structures that people often critique sort of independently, like corporate capitalism or authoritarian government, and they all sometimes treat them like they're these separate institutions, but we treat them as this as an integrated system. And this book is about the strategy and tactics needed to accomplish that goal.
Yes, we look at a lot of the different strategies that various resistance movements have used in the past and try to explain to sort of a general audience why do some strategies work in some situations and not in others. I think one of the problems on the left is that nonviolence has really been kind of the only moral option. It's been made into this moral question. So it's never about, well, is this effective? When is it effective? What are the situational constraints that make it be effective or not? It's always just, at this point, you must believe this or else you're not a moral person. And I want to take that out of the equation and just say this is one tactic among many. When it works, it's extremely elegant and extremely effective. But look what it takes to make it work. So you have to understand what the tactics are that you are proposing against whatever the enemy is that you've identified. And I feel like all of that kind of analysis has really dropped out of the left, and all we're left with is it's just a default. Yes, of course, you're only going to use nonviolent kinds of methods, and most of them the extremely ineffective kinds. So, you know, have a protest, sign a petition. They're not even doing direct actions against the infrastructure that's destroying the planet. It's, the most kind of risk-free sort of ways to even do nonviolent action because they're still not directly confronting power. They're just in a position of begging at this point. So so a lot of that is going into the book, trying to get people to think more strategically about what you are up against, depending on who your enemy is, and how are you actually going to affect those structures of power, given, you know, what your constraints are in terms of resources, in terms of people, in terms of what you have at your disposal to fight with. And a lot of times, nonviolence is not going to be the answer, because what it depends on is great numbers of people. I mean, you can bring down really entrenched and vicious systems of power using nonviolence. South Africa, all across Eastern Europe, they brought down the Soviet Union, and there was only one of those countries ended up, having a violent conflict over it, and the rest was totally nonviolent. So in my own lifetime, I've seen this work, but it takes massive numbers of people. And if you don't have those massive numbers, it's not going to work. So if we had enough people to put their bodies between what is left of our planet and fossil fuel, it could certainly be done. But I don't see massive numbers of people being willing to do this. Given that there's a small number of people who might be willing, what are the tactics then that can be used to try to make a dent in this? And that's pretty much the question that I'm grappling with in writing this book.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure listeners don't get the idea that there's absolutely no one kind of bridging those gaps, because I think like there are people right now and involved in lots of stuff against the NAFTA superhighway I-69 in Indiana,
sure.
And there's people numerous times over the last year trying to lock down to like a coal power plant and mm-hmm. The construction company supplying the coal power plant and stuff like that. So I think it's good to mention that there are, like, just so listeners at least know that there are people out there who are trying to do different things that aren't just about lifestyle things, but also looking at, the actual, like, bulk of the problem.
I have the highest respect for people who are in Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. My only concern is that we build on that and think further up the food chain in terms of structure, because, you know, we could break every McDonald's window across America. It wouldn't make a difference. We need to think further up the kind of industrial, food chain, basically. To make our actions more effective. So this is not in any way to, dismiss the courage or the dedication of people who are putting their lives on the line and are willing to, really try to protect the voiceless and the powerless, like trees and animals and people who really don't have a voice. But I just think we need to be thinking more systemically to make our actions, to kind of use our actions as a lever in whatever way is possible. Because the more individual kind of actions if they're not part of a larger strategy, they end up being ineffective. And I want us to be effective at this point. We don't have a lot of time left.
Mm-hmm. Can you think you can maybe talk about, or talk in some more practical and relevant ways about what a cult of resistance could look like, and maybe bring that down to earth a little bit more? I'm curious to know what you've thought of.
Well, I have one example that I like to give people, which was a book I was reading about Northern Ireland, and there was a young guy who was in a altercation with the military police and was shot, and he managed to get away, and he was lying in an alleyway for a few hours, sort of slowly bleeding to death, and three guys were coming home from work in the factory, and they stumbled upon him, and they didn't even have to ask any questions. They knew what a bullet wound was, and they knew what to do about it, and they picked him up, and they carried him to a safe house and got him a doctor. And, you know, a month later, he was well enough to travel, and they had produced a good enough passport for him that he was able to get out of the country until it was safe for him to return. Now, that's what a culture of resistance does. They know who the warriors are. They know what to do for them when they fall. They know how to take them in. They know how to take care of them. They know how to get the material resources, and they know how to keep their mouths shut. That would be a real culture of resistance. If we were supporting people who were willing to take militant action to that degree, we don't have that on the left. So that's what I would say, loyalty, material support. We also need public spokespeople. I mean, I think that's a lot of what Derek Jensen is. He's the one who, more than anybody, go out in public and talk about how necessary these actions are. So if you can't do the actions, you need to talk about them and how important it is to do them. If you are somebody who can do more militant action, great. But there needs to be a firewall, too, to keep everybody safe. So I would say those were, you know, some of the main components of having a culture of resistance. I mean, almost any of us can give some kind of material support, and all of us can certainly give loyalty. So I would say those are the two big ones toward building that. But it has to be self-conscious. And we have to be consciously linked to the people who are doing those kind of militant direct actions. And I see that really, really missing on the left. Because there's this sort of moral abhorrence of anything except, you know, the most limp sort of, you know, nonviolent, I don't even want to call it that, because nonviolent direct action actually usually is supposed to be a direct confrontation with power. It's just that you're not using weapons. And I have, you know, a great deal of respect for people who have used that successfully, because it can be quite elegant. But we're not even doing that on the left in terms of, you know, stopping global warming, and that could be done. I mean, a few thousand people could shut down Washington, D.C. They could shut down Manhattan. It wouldn't be that hard. I mean, the interstate highway system could be shut down in a matter of an hour if we had those kinds of numbers, but we don't. So that's where, you know, in the book we're trying to, well, if you had those main numbers, these are things you could do, and you could do this nonviolently. If you didn't have those kinds of numbers, well, what are the other strategies people have used in occupation situations? So we need to recognize this as an occupation, that, you know, the government and the corporations do not have our best interests at heart, that what they want is to keep gutting the land until everything is desert and turning it into their profit. I don't know what they think they're going to eat or breathe at that point, but that's the trajectory we're about to end with. Anyway, that's what I think the culture of resistance really needs to do, is loyalty and material support, sort of wrapped up in a conscious embrace of a more militant strategy that actually has a goal, which is saving the planet.
Eric, do you have anything you want to add?
No, that sounds really great.
Okay. I'm kind of curious to know from your perspectives, like, I guess that recent conference was this past weekend, so I'm assuming it's really fresh in your minds, and I'm curious to know what kind of inspirations you left with coming from that, and the cross-section of people you were with there, and what, just the general feeling you get, and what do you think is worth working towards from here and realistic to work towards?
Well, one of the things that I was really impressed by was that, you know, it's not like people are totally unaware of tactics other than things like letter writing and, you know, buying supposedly green products and petitions. Because when we ran these Feralia scenarios, and we sort of had people thinking about cultures of occupation, about resistance, and about cultures of resistance at a one-step remove, they came up with all these amazing, and in some cases very detailed and specific tactics that people could use in virtually every walk of life for resistance. And people actually, in some cases, you know, went list by list, and they said, well, you know, here's what you could do if you were a janitor to support a culture of resistance, and here's what you could do if you were an IT worker, and this sort of thing. So I was really happy and inspired to see that, in a pinch, you know, people are capable and are willing of thinking in this way and of coming up with really impressive solutions.
Yeah, and again, I think this is the failure of the leadership and the vision in the environmental movement, because when you ask people to think like this, they can. And in fact, they were very enthusiastic about it. I mean, it was a great weekend. But up to this point, nobody's really asked them to do it. So that's part of our frustration, is that we are at this crisis point of life on Earth, and we are still not asking those kinds of very pointed strategic questions about what we're going to do. You know, the relief is that people can do it if you ask them to. So we intend to keep asking. We have another workshop coming up at the end of October in Oregon, in Lincoln City, Oregon, and then we're doing it again in March in Rowe, Massachusetts, which is here on the East Coast. So, yeah, east or west, you can come. We don't have anything in the middle of the continent, but maybe that'll happen. So,
I'm intrigued by that, how most people, like, I find it's fairly easy when you kind of get out of your regular circle to meet all kinds of people with all kinds of different jobs who, you know, have pretty subversive thoughts and, like, totally crave to be involved in something that's really fulfilling and really makes a difference, you know?
Yeah.
And these people, like, don't need to be ever identified or associated with any kind of quote-unquote activist culture. And in fact, most people are really alienated by kind of activist culture, you know?
Yeah.
But there's these people who are out there, and I'm just feeling like a lot of people really look at the urgency and the collapse that you speak of, or that actually is going on. Many people kind of look at that as something that's still in the distance, or it's not quite right time yet, or I mean, like, because you have all kinds of people doing all kinds of different actions and organizing, but for some reason it's still not, you know, breaking, like, it's not getting people really feeling like it's time. A lot of people say that, like, maybe there'll come a time for this and that, but right now it's still about, like, raising people's consciousness and all that. And I'm just curious to know, what do you think it'll take to get there? Like, do you think in past examples of other social scenarios it'll take massive starvation, like being hit, like, right in front of your face? Or do you think it's possible to actually act a bit preemptively? Of course, acting preemptively would have been acting decades or eons ago. But what I mean, and given this current context right now, what do you think about that?
It's never too late to be preemptive.
No.
I think that we're going to have a lot of opportunities in the future to make a bigger dent in people's consciousness. The problem right now, of course, is that it's still most of the crisis that people are going to experience is in the future. It's not here yet. They're not starving in the streets yet. Gas is not $20 a gallon yet. They can still get to work. They can still get to the mall. There's still plenty of cheap plastic crap to buy. So when their daily lives are that affected, there's going to be a lot of entree points for people like us. And they'll be more willing to question because it's starting to crumble. Right now, it's not yet. I mean, there's definitely a pinch in terms of money, but beyond that, there's still plenty of food. Nobody's in a bread line yet. So I think that the best opportunities to build are yet to come, and that frightens me because the time to act was yesterday. You know, the carbon just keeps, it's this huge lag, it's the flywheel effect of the carbon buildup. And I don't think people realize, because they live in these urban environments and what gerrymander calls the technosphere, we don't live in the biosphere anymore, and they don't realize that songbird populations are collapsing and that the fish are collapsing and that the plankton populations are collapsing, and the sort of the basic level of the food chain, it's coming apart. Okay, but because there's still food at the supermarket, they don't get the emergency yet. And I'm afraid of that lag time. I mean, I'm just afraid that by the time we have enough people who are really willing, it's going to be too late. We don't have a lot of time left.
Mm. There's very much also that kind of shifting baseline thing going on,
right,
where people compare to what it was when they were younger. But they don't think about how, you know, all of the species that have gone extinct much before then. They don't talk about how the penguin used to be a name that was used to refer to the great auk, which was, you know, an extremely important bird species in terms of feeding and in terms of producing basic guano fertilizer. until they were totally wiped out. Or they'd talk about how cod is a different species than, you know, initially people talked about it as. And just this last week, we're hearing stories about the Arctic Sea, you know, literally frothing in spots because methane that's been frozen on the seabed is now being released into the atmosphere by warming temperatures. So we're really looking at a tipping point in the face. So we might not be looking at, you know, the point at which global warming is so bad that it's turning the Amazon rainforest into a desert, but we're definitely looking at the point where within years or possibly months, we're kind of reaching the no return, the point of no return, at which any actions we undertake will have far less leverage on global warming than they would now. And I kind of hope that our strategy book will help put some of those more isolated people that you're talking about, Matt, into a point where they can think about actions that they can undertake as part of that strategy now.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how, like, I wonder what this, because I think with the methane and all that burping up from the ocean and these huge chimneys, I feel like the tipping point already was passed years ago. I mean, people are talking about it at 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide, and they stopped talking about that. Now they're talking about 500 or whatever, and you know, we passed 400 a while ago, it seems. Are we already, it's for sure, and I feel like there's so many surprises the Earth has waiting for us, like the giant peat bog in Russia or Siberia and like all this methane. And I feel like, do you often think it's good just to work from the point that, like, you know, it's too late to stop runaway feedback loops and completely cataclysmic, irreparable earth-changing, like, climate collapse, you know, and work from the point where we're going to have to deal with complete fallout of manufacturing industries and, you know, everyone's jobs and all that? Or, like, given that kind of context, what do you think the point is of organized resistance against the system, as you guess you'd say? Like, if a hurricane is going to take out a dozen oil rigs, uh-huh, what's the point of working against the oil industry and that kind of thing? I'm curious to know what you think about that.
Well, I still think that it's really important. I think it can still get worse. You know, it's definitely true that these kind of warnings have changed. In the 1980s, people used to say, oh, well, we have to act in the next 10 years, you know. The next 10 years is the point of no return for the planet. And in some ways, they were probably right. But I don't know if it ever gets bad enough that there's no point in resisting anymore. There's always something that we can save. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, in terms of oil rigs, I think this is kind of a tangent, but especially in terms of peak oil, you know, some people talk about peak oil. They're like, oh, great, well, peak oil will kind of, like, stop global warming, it'll make industrial civilization scale back, we don't really have to worry about it. But peak oil is not going to cut it. It's not going to stop the runaway greenhouse effect, and really there's no financial collapse, there's no internal systems collapse that is going to relieve those of us in relatively privileged responsibility or in relatively privileged positions in the first world from our responsibility to resist. To resist this civilization, to resist these exploitative power structures, because they can always make it worse.
And I would just say we have a moral responsibility to do what we can to save our planet. And, I mean, we can make moral exhortations, and it doesn't usually work, but I would also say, isn't there something you love? I mean, every one of us has to love something, or we wouldn't be alive. And if we love something, isn't it worth fighting for it?
Yeah, it's as simple as that. I wonder if you have any closing words. We're just about at the end of our interview here. Anyone, if you want to wrap things up at all for a few minutes?
I think if there's anybody left 100 years from now, they're going to wonder what the fuck was wrong with us that we didn't fight like hell when the planet was going down. And this is our last moment to fight. So we have to do it.
Eric?
Yeah, I can't really say it better than that.
I thank you both so much for coming on the air with me and for doing what you do and sharing all these words.
Great. Well, I hope some of your listeners will come to our future workshops or at least read the book when it comes out.
How about how can people learn about what you're up to?
The Air has a website.
Yeah, you can go to Derek's website, derekjensen.org, or you can go to my website, leairkeith.com, or you can go to Eric's website, which is inthewake.org.
Yep.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah, and so our schedules are up there, and you can read all about it.
Great. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.